Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. September 11th, 2001 was 20 years ago, long enough that many young adults don't remember it personally, but only from reading or hearing about it. But for anyone old enough to remember, it's like Pearl Harbor was for the World War II generation. For myself, I was on the phone with a client when she mentioned that a plane had just hit the World Trade Center. And I went and turned on TV in a couple minutes, and I saw the first tower burning. And I thought, gee, it's a terrible accident. But there were some guys working on our roof outside, so I went outside to talk to them for a minute, and I told them what was happening. And we all ended up standing in my living room watching as the second plane hit. And I said, my God, Osama bin Laden just got what he wanted. And I remember the assistant roofer asked, who's Osama bin Laden? It was that incomprehensible for most Americans at that moment in time. Within a short while, a third plane had hit the Pentagon, and very soon all U.S. air traffic was grounded. That was, you know, I looked at the air traffic map for the country, and it was weird to see all of those lines just go whoosh and just disappear, except for a few. And among the flights still in the air was United Flight 93 out of Newark International Airport, bound for San Francisco. The flight had seats for 182 passengers, but along with seven crew members, there were only 37 passengers aboard that morning, far fewer than usual. And they included four Al-Qaeda hijackers. So what made Flight 93 different from the others was that it had sat on the runway for about 45 minutes due to congestion. So it was late taking off, and the hijackers aboard took longer than the other plane's hijackers had to start their attack. And what that meant was that right away, as the passengers began to call their families, they knew that this was no ordinary hijacking. They knew, in fact, that they were aboard a cruise missile that would be flown into a target. And what was also unusual was that this small group of 33 random passengers happened to include several young men who, if you could hand-pick guys equipped to fight back against an attack like this, would be the men you would pick. They were an American dream team, I would say, even down to the diversity they represented. There was Jeremy Glick, a Jewish guy who had been the collegiate national junior judo champion. And I remember reading his former coach said a few days after 9/11, if Jeremy was faced with four assailants, he could, at his own discretion, incapacitate or kill any or all of them. Now, that's not your average passenger, right? He was so cool during the calls with his wife from the plane that he joked that he was ready. He was armed with his plastic butter knife from breakfast. Then there was Mark Bingham, a 6'4", 240-pound rugby player from San Francisco. And if you know what rugby is, it's even a rougher sport than football. I mean, he was a big, powerful guy. And he was gay. He had played on University of California Berkeley's national championship rugby team and was a member of San Francisco's gay rugby team league, and he had once tackled a mugger on a San Francisco street. I mean, this is a tough guy. He owned his own public relations firm in San Francisco and was planning to open a branch in New York City, which was what he was doing in that area at that time. Then there was Todd Beamer. He was a lead account manager with Oracle Corporation, a guy with an MBA, who had played baseball in both high school and college, lived with his family in New Jersey, and was very fit. There were others aboard. A guy named Lou Naki was a 200-pound weightlifter with Superman tattooed on his shoulder. And a Japanese student named Toshiya Kuje played American football, and he was a linebacker. Richard Guadagno was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service manager who was trained in hand-to-hand combat. Another passenger, Andrew Garcia, had been an air traffic controller with the California Air National Guard. There were some strong women aboard, too. Flight attendant Cece Lyles was a former policewoman, a black woman from the town where I went to high school, Fort Pierce, Florida. Passenger Deora Bodley had been captain of her high school basketball team, and two other women passengers were trained emergency medical technicians. Now, I've saved passenger Tom Burnett for last, but he was certainly not least of the core group of four men who planned and led what turned into a fight against the hijackers. He was the vice president and chief operating officer of a medical devices company based in California. He traveled so much that he'd married a flight attendant named Dina. And Dina is my guest this morning. Welcome, Dina.
Thank you, Court. I'm kind of giggling over the fact that he married a flight attendant. Thank you for having me on morning. Thank you.
Yeah, that was ironic, but I guess the description is probably accurate that he was in the air more than he was on the ground. And
it's
so it was
true.
Easy for him to meet you. And when he met you, he knew he'd met the right one, right? So we're so glad and honored to have you on. And you and really some of the other wives are our last direct connection with these four heroes. You're part of their story, and therefore you're also part of American history. It's no exaggeration, really. And it's been 20 years, and I know you're remarried, but I'm sure that day is as vivid in your mind as if it were yesterday. I would imagine these anniversaries are still emotional for you, so thanks again for being on to talk with us about it. So I tell you first, why don't you just tell us about Tom? How did you first meet and what was he like?
Tom and I first met when I had just finished flight attendant training in Atlanta, Georgia. And we actually met through my roommate at the time. Her name is Camille Bowler. She was from New Orleans and just has a wonderful spirit, very friendly. And so Camille and I had gone to a happy hour that was really just outside of our apartment complex at a Chevy's. And that Chevy's was attached to a hotel where Tom was staying. So Camille met Tom at Chevy's while she was waiting on a margarita to be made. And she brought it back to our table. And there were about 20 of us who had just graduated from flight attendant training. And she just announced, she goes, "Hey, this is my new friend, Tom. He is moving here and looking for an apartment." And so we just started talking about the area and what a great place it is to live. And she said, "He's going to join us." So he sat down and joined us for happy hour. And we just enjoyed his company so much that we asked him to go with us downtown for dinner. He got in his car. We all got in our cars, drove downtown, and enjoyed the evening. At the end of the night, Camille listed all 20 of our names and telephone numbers and gave them to Tom and said, I just know we're going to be instant friends. Just feel free to call us if you have any questions. Let's get together again. And about a week later, there was a message on the voice recorder that he would love to take Camille and me to. Actually, he said that he wanted to grill out for us, that we were invited over to his new apartment. So Camille was on a trip. I called him back and said, I don't know you, so I'm not coming to your apartment, but I'll meet you at a restaurant. So we met at Applebee's and we closed the restaurant down talking. We stayed there for hours, just having the most wonderful conversation. And he called a few days later and asked me on a proper date. And I'll never forget, after the second time of meeting him, I was talking to my mom about him. And she said, "Oh my goodness, you sound smitten." And I said, "I'm going to marry him." I said, "Don't tell him, but I'm going to marry him." So I knew right away. It took him about 3 or 4 weeks to get on board with that, but I knew right away.
Well, that's great. One of those almost love at first sight and matches made in heaven kind of thing. And, but speaking of matches, I said that these guys, particularly the core four of them, formed a dream team. I mean, Tom and Jeremy Glick, Mark Bingham, and Todd Beamer. And so Tom, I know, played quarterback in high school and college until he was injured in college and had to quit. And I read that his father said, Tom used to tell us that everything slowed down after the snap, that he could see the whole field. He could see the play taking shape. He could see the order and the chaos. And his father said, "I believe that is exactly what happened on the plane." And, that's definitely what talented athletes have. They call it being in the zone. And, it just everything slows down. Like a pitcher with a 95 mile an hour fast pitch coming at him, it's like it's coming slow and he can hit it wherever he wants,
Yeah.
And it's that kind of thing. And so that's what makes a leader in a crisis situation. So Tom, I know, made several phone calls to you during the hijacking, and in a couple of them, he told Dina that he and a group of other passengers were putting together a plan to retake the plane, and he said, and I'm kind of quoting some of these things that I've read, but don't worry, we're going to do something. And in a later call, I think he said, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it's pretty close, I imagine. If they're going to drive this plane into the ground, we've got to do something. So do you think? I mean, first of all, is that what he said, or you can add to other things he said too in those calls, but do you think he was probably the main planner?
Oh, absolutely. I have no doubt. He did make several phone calls to me from the plane. Ours was the first one that came from Flight 93. So it was new information at the time we were talking. So the first phone call he made, he just was, very point blank. He said, "I'm on United Airlines Flight 93 from Newark to San Francisco. The plane has been hijacked." He said, "I need you to call the authorities. The hijackers are trying to get into the cockpit. They've already knifed a guy." And then he said he would call me back, and he hung up the phone. And I called 911. They connected me to the FBI. As I was explaining to the FBI that this was not one of the airplanes that had already hit the World Trade Center, but a third airplane, Tom called back. And at that point, I told him about the World Trade Center, and he started asking questions. He knew immediately. He said the words, "It's a suicide mission." And he wanted to know who the hijackers were, what were they going to do with his plane, what did they want. And I answered his questions with information I was getting from the news reporter on TV. At that time, we didn't know if they were cargo planes, commercial planes, private planes. We didn't know how many there were. People were, just kind of hypothesizing who these hijackers were. And we had no idea that it was a terror group at that point, but he knew it was a suicide mission. And so you could tell he was gathering the information and trying to sort it out. He was also passing that information on to other people on the plane. And so after that second phone call he made to me, they started calling their family members wanting to know, "Hey, what do you know? What's going on?" You know, and many of them were calling to say goodbye also. So no doubt that Tom was the leader. He was always the leader. He rarely ever took orders from anyone else. But I have no doubt that this was absolutely a perfect situation with the crew members, the passengers, and the skills that each one brought to the table. Not a group that, you know, a terrorist organization would want to go up against if you've only got four against, 28. But yes, I have no doubt that Tom led the group, stood up first and said, "We've got to do something. Let's put a plan together. Let's go down this aisle and take back this plane." And yes, at one point in the conversation, I think it was our third conversation, I had told him, I kind of reverted back to my flight attendant training, and I told him, "I need you to sit down, be still, be quiet, and don't draw attention to yourself." And he just yelled into the phone at that point. He goes, "No, no. If they're going to drive this plane into the ground, we're going to do something." And so at that point, I just became very meek. I sat down, I listened, I tried to hear, you know, what was going on in the background. It just sounded like a normal flight. I didn't hear anything but the hum of the engine. And he told me they were waiting until they were over a rural area to take back the plane. He said everything would be okay, not to worry. He'd be home that night. He said to tell the girls he would talk to them later, because they were pulling on my bathrobe wanting to talk to him on the phone. It was one of those situations in which Tom and I talked to each other by phone dozens of times every day because he traveled so much. And those conversations that we had from Flight 93 were just like every other conversation we've ever had. You know, the first conversation, he was irritated that his plane had been hijacked and he was trying to get home and now they were delaying him. The second conversation, he was concerned, but he was gathering information, putting a plan together. And the third phone call, he just said, "I don't want you to worry. Everything's going to be okay. We're going to take the plane back. We're waiting till we're over a rural area. Tell the kids I'll talk to them later." At one point, he said, "I'll be home tonight. I may be late, but I'll be home." So,
well, at that point, he was reassuring you, and I think he probably knew there was a good chance that what did happen would happen at that point. But and he was being a guy. He was reassuring you, so you didn't freak totally out quite yet. But and there was always a chance, right? But I mean, everybody, as you said, was using their seat back phones. This is 20 years ago, right? When they had phones in the back of the seat and you could use them, and people weren't allowed to use their cell phones, but they were in this case, and they could reach cell phone towers at different points. So everybody was both saying goodbye and getting information, as you said, Dina. So Todd Beamer, in a way, his call became the most famous one because he was connected to an airphone operator, and he told her the flight had been hijacked and that two people who he thought were the pilots were lying on the floor, either dead or injured, and He said one of the hijackers had a red belt with what looked like a bomb strapped to his waist and was saying it was a bomb, but he didn't necessarily believe it. And he recited the Lord's Prayer and the 23rd Psalm with this operator. And then he said to the other men, so, and he probably to Tom, you know, are you ready? Okay, let's roll. And that became like the kind of the bumper sticker of the whole event in a way, let's roll. Similarly, like Jerry Glick's last words to his wife were, okay, we're going to rush the hijackers. So at that point, they had all, these four guys in particular and some other people with them, had gelled into an attack group. Now, remember that this is a 757 and the aisle is narrow. You can't, you know, run at them like a football squad with 11 men attacking in a flanking way. You got to go like basically single file up the aisle real fast. And so the group rushed the cockpit, whose doors were locked, using probably a food cart, it seemed like, as a battering ram. And they overpowered and probably killed one of the hijackers who'd been stationed as a guard outside the cockpit, while the Al-Qaeda hijacker at the controls kept radically swinging the plane from side to side and up and down, trying to throw them off. But when they were about to get into the cockpit, and from the cockpit voice recorder, it sounds like they probably did, at the end, just breach the cockpit and get in, and were about to attack, you know, and take the plane away from the hijackers. The hijacker turned the plane upside down and flew it into the ground at like 563 miles an hour near the town of Shanksville, Pennsylvania, instantly killing everybody, of course, but they didn't hit their target, whatever it was going to be. So you described, Dina, how you learned what was happening, but just briefly, what was happening at your house while this whole drama was going on and while you were on the phone with Tom? Were there, was law enforcement there with you right away? I mean, just kind of briefly.
After the first phone call from Tom, I had called 911, and the first person they connected me to was the local police department. So they actually sent over several policemen as well as the fire department. The EMTs arrived, the fire trucks were there, there were several police cars. And all this while, I was carrying the telephone around trying to get the girls ready for school. So I continued keeping them on schedule while, you know, they were taking the girls out to show them the fire truck. They were taking pictures of them in the police cars. And the EMTs were trying to check my blood pressure. And, you know, I was just trying to get Hallie upstairs to brush her teeth. So I think in all of the chaos, I reverted back to, I had to keep my kids on schedule because that's the kind of mom I was. And they were trying to make sure that we were okay, that, you know, I wasn't having a heart attack because of what was going on. My thoughts were with the phone. I was really just waiting for my husband to call back. That's all I wanted, that I was trying to keep myself busy so that I didn't lose my mind in the process of it all.
Sure. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking today with Dina Burnett, now Dina Burnett Bailey, who was the wife of Tom Burnett, who was one of the small group of heroes who tried to take back United Flight 93 on September 11th, 2001, and ended up forcing the hijackers to crash the plane rather than to get to their target and do what the other planes had done. So, Dina, I'd read that you and Tom both had several strong and even fairly detailed premonitions about this event quite a while back before it happened. Can you share those with us just for a few minutes?
It's kind of funny that you bring that up. Not many people do, but you're right. We did have, I call it, just God's way of preparing us for what was about to take place. He was just whispering to us for several years. When my third daughter, Anna Claire, was born, I was holding her, and my mom came into the hospital room, and she was looking over us, and she made the comment, I guess you'll have to have a fourth child so Tom can have his son. And I looked down at Anna Claire, and I said, no, Mom, God's not going to give me a son. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, God knows that I can't raise Tom's son by myself. And my mom stood there looking at me, just not knowing what to say. I think she dismissed it as postpartum, but I remember this incredible peace coming over me and just thinking that I was in the presence of angels.
And you talked, I mean, Tom apparently was having the same kind of, let's call it almost vision or premonition himself, but he didn't share it with you and you didn't share yours with him for some time. I mean, that was another part of what I read about this story, that you were both in parallel having the same extremely unusual and strange picture that you finally then shared with each other. So just briefly, how did that happen?
And I'll also say that his mom was also, so just briefly, his mom developed this incredible fear of flying because she just knew that the plane was going to crash. And so she would not get on an airplane. She had many opportunities to travel, and she just stopped traveling, which was odd because she had traveled by plane her whole life. But in those last 3 or 4 years, she refused to get on a plane because she would say that I keep having visions of a plane crash. I know it's going to crash. And so with Tom, he came to me the summer of 2001, and we were standing in the kitchen. I'll never forget it. He said, I want to talk to you. He said, have you wondered why I haven't been coming home for lunch when I'm in the office? And I said, well, I assumed you were just working through lunch. And he said, I've been going to daily mass. And I turned to him and said, why? Now, Tom was Catholic, and we always went to church on Sunday, but I had never known him to just go to church every day unless something was wrong. And he said, I feel like God is trying to prepare me for something, and I don't know what it is. And so I thought that if I can spend more time in church and more time in prayer, maybe I'll be able to figure it out. And I said, well, do you have any idea? And he said, I don't know what it is, but I know it involves a lot of people, and it has something to do with the White House. And of course, as his wife, I said, he wants you to run for president. and of course, I was serious. I mean, here's this smart guy who's, you know, good looking and has it going on. And he goes, no, that's not it. That's not it. You can really tell that he was tormented by it, just trying to communicate in a way that he never had with God before, just felt very strongly about it.
Well, the target of the hijackers of Flight 93 turned out to be either the White House or the U.S. Capitol. And in piecing together intelligence after the fact, there was last-minute disagreement apparently among bin Laden and his lieutenants about which one to hit. And the general belief that, you know, our intelligence ended up with is that the White House was their prime target. And if they couldn't hit that for some reason, partly because it was smaller, I guess, then the Capitol was the backup. So that fits his premonition that something that he was destined to be part of that involved a lot of people also involved the White House. So that was really something, you know, but it was an odd coincidence that most of the central heroes of this story only happened to be on the flight. I mean, both Jeremy Glick and Todd Beamer were originally scheduled on other flights, and Mark Bingham almost missed the flight and was the last one to come running aboard just before they closed the doors. So, I mean, here's another question that's kind of along the lines of what we've been talking about now. I mean, do you think it's possible that Tom and the other brave and capable guys were fated to be together on this particular flight?
Absolutely. I think so. I think that their actions were pivotal in the day. And I also think that they helped change the mindset of millions around the world as to what a hero is and to the fact that one person can make a difference. And, you know, I think, too, that it really inspired people to think about what they can do and the power that they have. And so, yes, I think that those four guys coming together and everyone on that plane, I think, was intended to be there for a purpose, whatever purpose they served that morning. And no doubt that every one of them died a hero. Every one of them played a part. And I do think very strongly that it was not by chance.
It kind of seems that way. I mean, you know, you got 33 people, and out of them, you know, at least half of them were, you know, athletic and people who could think on their feet, intelligent, you know, people who were brave and, you know, had initiative. I mean, you don't get that normally in a random group of people. And it was definitely that way there. And that's what it took to avert, which would have been an extension of a catastrophic, disastrous day, right? So they at least short-circuited one part of it, the part that was under their control. So, you know, we're getting toward the end of the show now, Dina, but what was life like for you in the first weeks and months? Again, briefly, I hate to keep using that word briefly, but this could definitely be an hour show, but it's only a half hour show.
Well, and I'm a talker, so I could keep talking. But I will say this, in the first few days, I came to realize very quickly that I needed to set an example for my daughters. And I kept asking myself the question, if my daughter were in this situation, what would I do? And so that helped push me forward. I relied on my faith, my family, my friends, my community, and they played a huge role in propelling us into the life that we have today. And I just want to say, you know, thank you to all of those who said a prayer, who waved a flag, who remembered us with good thoughts, and who wrote letters called "It Meant More Than You Will Ever Know."
And are still remembering all of you today as we are here in this show. You wrote a book about Tom in that day called Fighting Back, Living Life Beyond Ourselves. And I won't ask you to give a book review, but I think we've kind of given somewhat of a book review, but there's more to it than that. It's kind of an inspirational book. So again, you can get it on Amazon and the usual outlets. Fighting Back, Living Life Beyond Ourselves by Dina Burnett, D-E-E-N-A Burnett. You know, there have also been three films about Flight 93. One is a TV film by that name, and a movie titled United Flight 93, and a documentary called The Flight That Fought Back. Have you watched them?
Yes, I have. I've seen all of them. I actually interviewed lengthily with each of those movies. And the one that is The Flight That Fought Back, that one was actually inspired by my book. And so all three of those are great. And I will say that there have been more than 17 movies and documentaries made about Flight 93 alone around the world. And I participated in each of those scripts being written.
Well, that's great. It gave you a way to keep honoring his memory and keep your feet on the ground at the same time with it, I think, probably. But so there are a number of monuments that people can go see. The Flight 93 National Memorial is outside Shankville, Pennsylvania, if you happen to make it up that way. I think you would only go there to see the monument, probably. Huh? But there's the National 9/11 Memorial in the South Pool, which is in New York City. And there's actually a Tom Burnett 9/11 Memorial at the Mall of the Americas in Minnesota. And there are many others around the country. I mentioned flight attendant Cece Lyles from Fort Pierce, Florida, where I'm from, and which is also where one of our big stations, WQCS, broadcasts from. And there's a monument there, called Liberty Park, in her memory, which was pretty interesting. Well, Dina, this is a personal question I want to end with, but are you at peace with what happened that day now?
I am at peace with what happened on September 11th. I think that God has given me the grace to know that it served a purpose.
I can understand that, and I can hear that in everything you said today, so thank you. Well, it's ironic that we're observing this 20th anniversary at the same time as the long war in Afghanistan that those attacks brought about has finally ended, and in such a sad and chaotic way, but that doesn't diminish one bit the heroism, the inspiration that your husband, Dina, and the others who fought back with him displayed that day. And that will live forever. And we thank you again, Dina, for being on with us on American Variety here today to relive it.
Thank you. And thank you for remembering, Court.
We'll never forget. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.